Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 6.
According to Plato, when all the classes in a society are doing what they're qualified to do and doing it well, then the state functions harmoniously or justly. Similarly, everyone has different impulses in his soul, and when they are in equilibrium, the individual is just. In this way, there's a direct connection between justice in the state and justice in the individual, a claim that Plato had assumed at the very beginning of the Republic. From our world of 20th century democracy, Plato's version of utopia involves certain obvious difficulties. The Republic constantly subordinates the good of the individual to the good of the state, allowing little, if any, room for self-determination. To be sure, in Plato's view, this is done for the good of the individual as well as for the good of the state, but this is a considerable restriction on the individual. It's fair to say, in fact, that Plato does not introduce a conception of individual rights at all. This by itself might make Plato's Republic seem much less than an ideal state. There is, however, one crucial feature in Plato's account that distinguishes his Republic from the varieties of totalitarianism experienced in the 20th century, tyrannies to which the Republic is sometimes compared. Plato repeatedly insists that those who govern must truly be qualified by ability and by education. They govern not because they have seized power, but because they have the wisdom required for solving the problems that any state encounters. This is the ideal. And if they don't have such wisdom, they would not be in power. This, at least, is Plato's stipulation. And he insistently reminds us that the alternative is that government should be in the hands of people who gain power either by guile, deceiving the people whom they rule, or by physical force. He compares the true guardian to the captain of a ship. What would happen, he asks, if the crew did not believe that their leader should be the captain?
Conceive the sailors to be wrangling with one another for control of the helm, each claiming that it is his right to steer, though he has never learned the art and cannot point out his teacher or any time when he studied it. And, what is more, they affirm that it cannot be taught at all. But they are ready to make mincemeat of anyone who says that it can be taught. And, meanwhile, they are always clustered about the captain, importuning him, and sticking at nothing to turn the helm over to them. And sometimes, if they fail, and others get his ear, they put the others to death, or cast them out from the ship. And then, after binding or drugging the worthy captain, they take command of the ship and consume its stores. And, if that were not enough, they praise and celebrate as a navigator, a pilot, a master of shipcraft, the man who is most cunning to lend a hand in persuading the captain to let them rule. While the man who lacks this craft, they condemn as useless.
Some critics believe that Plato's description of the faults of democracy would be convincing only if he proposed a practical alternative. He might be convincing, for example, if we could be certain that the people who gain power are indeed those who are best qualified. But have most political leaders achieved the status of guardians? Can such an ideal, or the ideal of the Republic as a whole, really be realized? Plato recognizes the practical difficulties that stand in the way of this. But in his view, even these do not diminish the importance of his ideal.
What we sought was a model to show us what justice was. We were not trying to show that the thing is possible. Take a painter now. If he should paint a pattern of the ideally beautiful man, but he could not prove that such a man is possible, do you think he would be the worse painter for that?
In other words, ideals are important, whether or not they can be fully realized. The crucial question is whether they are indeed ideals. He Even if we accepted everything Plato is so far claimed about the Republic, we would still not know exactly what equips the Guardians for their role. What is the knowledge or wisdom they require? To answer this question, Plato feels obliged to introduce us to his general theory of knowledge, a theory which applies not only to politics, but wherever knowledge is required for making judgments or decisions. Plato's theory is based first on the distinction between genuine knowledge and sense experience, between knowledge and the opinions or beliefs that often pass themselves off as knowledge. In one of the most famous passages of the Republic, Plato describes the contrast between knowledge and other forms of experience through the image of a divided line, a vertical line that he then cuts into four sections. The major distinction in the divided line is between knowledge and opinion.
There are these two entities. One of them is sovereign over the intelligible order, and the other over the world of the physical eye. There are then these two types, the visible and the intelligible.
Opinion, he suggests, is produced by the senses and the imagination, both of which leave the way open to errors and false beliefs. The least accurate form of opinion is based on phantasms and the images of dreams. Very little can be known from this source. Sense experience is a step above dreaming or phantasms, but sense experience also fails to yield genuine knowledge. Our senses frequently make mistakes. Even when we check up on them, we still may be mistaken because we usually check them with the senses themselves. The upper part of Plato's divided line represents knowledge in contrast to opinion. Unlike opinion, knowledge achieves certainty, although here too there are different kinds. One kind of certainty Plato assigns to mathematics. Mathematics produces certainty, however, only on the basis of assumptions or axioms that are themselves unproven. A second kind of knowledge, the highest level of knowledge, is reached through reason. Reason grasps those principles of experience which don't require any assumptions, apart from what the principles themselves provide. Plato gives these principles the special name of forms, and from these forms, he claims, both reality and knowledge are constituted. The ideal of justice that Plato hopes to define in the Republic is an example of a form. This ideal is objective, unchanging, independent of any particular historical setting. Much has been written about Plato's theory of forms. Indeed, it's the most famous of all his doctrines, the one most commonly associated with his name. But the questions that he himself hoped to answer by the theory of forms still remain in the aftermath of that theory. What exactly are the forms? What evidence is there that they exist? If they do exist, how can we come to know them? Plato answers all these questions beginning from the common experience of everyday life. People gain their first impression of justice or injustice from ordinary experience. This experience includes the ways they're treated by other people or the ways in which they see other people act towards one another. But our judgments of these individual experiences don't occur as individually or separately as the events themselves. So, for example, when we praise people or specific actions as just or good, Plato claims we're judging them by a single, common standard of justice or goodness that we bring to bear. But we can do this only if such a standard exists independently of the instances themselves. That is, if we can reapply the standard when new occasions arise. Plato holds,
a form is always one and the same. Particular things that have the property of a form obtain it by participating in or mingling with the form.
This holds true for all the qualities of which there are forms. For example, beauty is a form that is always one and the same.
If someone tells me that the reason why a given object is beautiful is that it has a gorgeous color or shape or any other such quality, I disregard all these other explanations. I cling simply and straightforwardly to the explanation that the one thing that makes the object beautiful is the presence in it, or in association with it, of absolute beauty. Beauty in itself.
For Plato, similar reasons imply the existence of justice and the other forms that are necessary for ethical judgment. For example, courage, piety, or temperance. The forms are never seen physically. They can only be known or thought. And yet, in Plato's conception, they are more real than objects that are seen or sensed. The values they name are, for him, objective and real. To be sure, logical consistency requires that similar forms should be admitted to exist for other qualities or objects as well. Plato says that forms do exist for everything, including those things which, like colors, may seem less important than ethical qualities. Thus, there is, in effect, a full world of forms, a world on which the other world of common experience is based. Plato holds that the world of forms is permanent and real. The world of common experience is constantly changing and occasional, and to this extent, common experiences are unreal. Any particular form, then, is more fundamental than the many particular sensible objects of which it is the form. The form could and often does exist without them, but not the other way around. One of Plato's most instructive descriptions of a form appears in the Republic in his account of the form of bedness. The existence of this unlikely principle, the form of the real bed, follows from the same line of reasoning that leads Plato to speak of forms elsewhere. The carpenter, he reminds us, makes a bed based on his conception of what a bed is. This conception, however, is more than only an idea in the carpenter's mind. It also reflects a structure or pattern that extends beyond him or any other carpenter.
The craftsman who produces a bed does so by fixing his eyes on the idea or form. And surely no craftsman makes the idea or form itself.
Indeed, all the beds, past, present or future, share certain objective properties, that is, properties which exist apart from any particular person's conception of them. Otherwise, there would be no common recognition of beds as beds. Bedness, then, is the form that enables, even causes, individual beds to be beds. To be sure, there are many different kinds and shapes of beds, but nonetheless, there's only one form or common principle that they all share. Plato explains this in the same way that he explains why there are forms at all.
If there were two forms of bedness, there would have to be another one of which the two would then possess the form or idea. And that would be the bed that really is, in and of itself, and not the other two.
Whether or not particular beds are different from each other in shape or material, they still retain the common features that make them beds. The craftsman who builds them imitates the form of bedness in order to make a bed that can be slept in. Yet the form itself can't be slept in, any more than can any other principle or definition. In this sense, the bed to be slept in is less real than the form of the bed. Why? Because the bed to be slept in could not exist without the form, but the form can exist without a physical example of it. By the same token, an artist who makes a painting of a bed produces an imitation of an imitation, a bed that can be seen but is not even slept in. This is another reason for Plato's repeated attacks on art and the artists. In their work, the painters and poets move further and further away from the world of forms. They are more removed from it than the world of sense experience.
The arts of imitation are far removed from truth. For it is phantoms, not realities, that they produce, only their semblance or appearance. If the artist were able to make the real thing, it is unlikely that he would devote himself to the imitation of them.
In the same way that particular beds are evidence for the form of bedness, instances of courage suggest a general form of courage. Instances of temperance and piety demonstrate that these forms exist. In instances of justice, tell us that there is a general form of justice. The theory of forms, then, is at the center of Plato's thinking about the ideal state and the nature of justice. The forms also are central to Plato's concept of reality more generally. So Plato holds that in order to be just, the state and its rulers must have access to the form of the good on which justice itself is based.
The form of the good is the cause of knowledge and truth, the highest of the forms, which, acting like the sun, illuminates all the others.
As we've seen, the Republic begins by questioning what role justice has in the life of the individual. It asks, for example, whether the just man is happier than the unjust man. To answer this, Plato turns to the question of what justice is in the state, since justice appears in the state on a larger scale than it does in the individual. But all these steps presuppose that there is such a thing as justice, and that human understanding can grasp it. In this way, the dialogue shows that thinking about the ideal state depends not only on evidence about laws and government, it also involves quite general questions about the nature of knowledge and reality. Plato repeatedly asserts that justice involves or presupposes knowledge. For justice to exist, knowledge must exist. This also explains why the rulers of the ideal republic have to know not only the form of justice, but all the other forms to which the form of justice is related. In a significant allegory on the Republic, Plato describes a cave in which a number of men are held prisoner. The men are tied up in such a way that they can only look straight ahead. All they can see, then, are shadows projected on the wall of the cave. Since the prisoners never see anything but these shadows, it's natural for them to think that the shadows on the wall are real. Nothing else exists for them. But suddenly, then, one of the prisoners is freed and makes his way out of the cave, emerging into the sunlight. The change is difficult for the freed man, and at first he refuses to look at the new world around him.
If he were compelled to look at the light itself, would not that pain his eyes? And would he not turn away and flee to those things which he is able to discern in the shadows, and regard them as more clear and more exact than the objects illuminated by the sun?
Gradually, however, the freed prisoner recognizes that the images he'd seen in the cave wall were indeed only shadows of the world that he now sees around him so clearly. Reluctantly, he returns to the cave and tells the other prisoners about his discovery. But they refuse to believe him. They know only the world of shadows. They have no reason to doubt that this world is real. In fact, they resent the returning prisoner and the news he brings about another reality. He wants them to give up their traditional beliefs. They might even kill him, Plato suggests, reminding us of what the Athenians did to Socrates when he suggested that they did not have the knowledge they thought they did. In this allegory, Plato says, the role of the escaped prisoner is the role of the philosopher.
This image we must apply as a whole to all that has been said, comparing the region revealed by sight with the habitation of the prison. And if you assume that the ascent from the cave and the contemplation of the things outside it is the mind's ascent to the realm of reason, you will not miss my own interpretation.
The philosopher's task is to demonstrate to others that there is a difference between the world of shadows and the real world. To reveal that difference is the constant challenge to reason and to the philosopher, as he attempts to teach others. This challenge applies to our thinking about politics and the state. Indeed, it applies to all thinking.
This is the end of Part 6. Please download Part 7 to continue.